With the latest agriculture news from across the state and the nation, here's Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. Here's your host, Taylor Hillman.
Good morning and welcome to Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. So the tariff talks are back on officially. Well, I guess they were never really off, but the U.S. is muscling back up on the trade tariff front right when we thought things were calming down a little bit. We'll have a report here on that in a couple of minutes. Looking ahead to next week, we will be catching up on several specialty crop industries and even a little conservation talk, hopefully. I will be at the Avocado Growers Seminar Series in San Luis Obispo and then a strawberry field day in Salinas. And it's that time of year again. Brian German will be checking out Cooperative Extension Advisor Joan Nunez's potato variety field day in Bakersfield, and he'll hit a citrus meeting on the way back up in Tulare. So stay tuned for all of that information, and if things work out perfectly, we may get a chance to visit with a dairy in Kern County that's doing some cool conservation work with the California NRCS. Fingers crossed on that last one. It is cooler in most of the listening areas of the show today, but temperatures will be right back to where they were to start the week by tomorrow and into the weekend. That is going to push progress on a lot of crops, especially in the valley areas, especially in almonds. Stay tuned for the interview segment in today's show. Whole split is just around the corner, and the Almond Board of California has five things growers need to remember this time of year. But for now, here's today's top story. It's back to conflict-oriented news regarding trade talks this week, and wine is involved in one of them. The U.S. announced two dates this week when new tariffs will be imposed on trading nations. Mexico and Canada have remained exempt from new metal tariffs the U.S. has put into place, but that exclusion ends this Friday. NAFTA talks are ongoing and are centered around automotive issues, but several ag issues are still at stake, including the newly spurred issue of Canada keeping imported wine off of British Columbian shelves. The Wine Institute says Canada is a big market for U.S. wine, which basically means California wine, a market that's just behind the European Union. Any change that would create a more even playing field in that market would include a lot of opportunities. Mexico is reportedly not involved in the meetings this week as they are out of the country, but Canada's Foreign Minister Chrystia Freeland is in Washington this week. Both the U.S. and Mexico have upcoming elections that would complicate timelines even more. Mexico's economy minister said there is a 40% chance a deal is done before their July 1st elections. The U.S. also announced that it will soon release a list of Chinese goods they will impose $50 billion worth of tariffs on. That's expected to be released in the middle of June. This announcement follows what seemed to be good news regarding relationships between the two countries. President Trump was rumored to have a deal worked out that involved a major Chinese tech company called ZTE, and China agreed to purchase more U.S. products. But none of those talks have been finalized, and the U.S. is seemingly moving forward with its original stance of what the administration called enhanced export controls. Now here's Brian German.
The Bovine General Order was adopted last year, putting forth conditions to protect water quality and applies to confined bovine feeding operations, which includes beef feedlots, auction markets, heifer raising operations, and calf ranches. Two workshops are going to be held in coming weeks to help address some of the questions surrounding the order's requirements. The order serves as general waste discharge requirements, incorporating provisions requiring the monitoring of surface water and groundwater to identify discharges. Director of Economic Analysis for Western United Dairymen, Annie Akmudi, offered some details about the upcoming workshops.
Those will just basically to support the heifer facility operators in understanding the new bovine general order and its requirements and all the timelines. So those are going to be hosted by the California Dairy Quality Assurance Program, CDQAP. The first meeting will be in Tulare on June 12th and the second in Modesto on June 14th.
Nominations are now being accepted through August 31st for the Women's Catalyst Award offered by the Center for Growing Talent. Vice President of the Talent Portfolio for the Center for Growing Talent by PMA, Alicia Calhoun, noted what the award recognizes.
PMA and the Center for Growing Talent has 5 awards of excellence overall that we award annually. And this one was specifically created to honor a leader in the industry annually from the fresh produce and floral industry, identifying someone who cultivates women's potential. And that is through mentoring women and providing a path for their leadership, development, and participation. So what's really key to focus on is that it is an award for somebody who is focused on women's mentoring and leadership, but the award recipient can be a man or woman because, as we know, there are many men who do support women in their leadership.
I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network.
A reminder for dairy producers of the new Margin Protection Program deadline. The National Association of Farm Broadcasters is helping remind dairy farmers they have until Friday to enroll in the retooled Dairy Margin Protection Program. The Department of Agriculture set a June 1st deadline for enrollment in the program that was revised by Congress earlier this year. USDA says many producers will see payments in early June, depending on the coverage they elect. The program protects dairy producers by paying them based on the difference between the national all milk price and the national average feed cost. The 2018 Bipartisan Budget Act made several changes to the safety net program to provide better protections for dairy producers from shifting milk and feed prices. Producers already enrolled in the program must still enroll in the new program if they have yet to do so already. The new program is retroactive for all of 2018. For more information and enrollment, farmers are encouraged to contact their local Farm Service Agency office. This is Farm City News Day by Agnet West. We'll have more of the day's agriculture news in just a moment. And remember, you can always get the latest agriculture news from around the state and the nation at our website, agnetwest.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Agnet West's Farm City News Day. More agriculture news for you now. An effort to reduce food waste in the United States highlights how dairy farms can recycle inedible products. Michael Clements has more.
A farmer participating in the No Taste for Waste campaign is recycling inedible foods to make electricity and fertilizer. The collaboration by the American Farm Bureau Federation and others seeks to reduce food waste, which accounts for up to 40% of all food produced. Farm Bureau member and Pennsylvania dairy farmer Brett Reinford is participating.
The No Taste for Waste campaign just recently started with a few pretty big partners that are involved with it. And so it's an initiative to bring awareness to food waste and to tell the food waste story and to bring people together to look for solutions.
Reinford uses an anaerobic digester to recycle food waste, which generates enough power to supply the farm and roughly 100 other homes.
We originally built it to reduce odor, which it does a pretty good job at doing that, but we soon found out after having it installed that we could put food waste in it and make even more electricity and more methane. So for the last 10 years, we've been recycling food waste, inedible food, that we've gotten from various sources over the years, retailers, and most recently now a lot from food manufacturers.
Reinford says there are other ways farmers and the food industry can help reduce food waste.
We think that food should go to those that are less fortunate first. So if there's extra food that a grocery store has, I think that's where it should be sent to, along with animal feeding operations. But when that's not a good option, we think that sending it to our digester or any digester in the United States is a better option than sending it to the landfill, because you're able to capture that energy from the food, which is the methane, and produce renewable electricity with it and heat.
Learn more at notasteforwaste.org. Michael Clements, Washington.
Well, in today's livestock news, USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service is reminding those in the poultry industry of the need for biosecurity after the recent confirmation of a case of virulent Newcastle disease here in California. As Rob Bain reports, it serves as a reminder that flock owners need to practice proper biosecurity measures.
15 years ago, USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service joined California Department of Food and Agriculture officials to combat cases of what was then known as exotic Newcastle disease, found in flocks of backyard poultry birds in Southern California. As APHIS Associate Deputy Administrator Burke Healy acknowledges, that was the start of heightened poultry biosecurity education and action.
We've done a lot of outreach for backyard birds. We've got a backyard security program out there. Certainly, the outbreak in 2014-15 of avian influenza informed the commercial producers to a large degree.
Now with a confirmed case of what is now known as virulent Newcastle disease within a premise of SoCal backyard exhibition chickens, Healy says biosecurity again needs to become forefront in the minds of poultry flock owners, regardless of flock size or operations. He clarifies that while VND does not pose either a human health risk or a food safety concern, this virus can spread rapidly among poultry and birds, and in unvaccinated birds is 100% fatal.
The symptoms can be variable from diarrhea to most often they will be a respiratory scenario with swelling around the head and the eyes, sneezing, challenged breathing, so the birds can't get air into their lungs, they'll turn bluish, or you can even have neurologic symptoms.
So in terms of proper biosecurity measures, Healy says poultry premise owners should remember this premise. Keep it clean and don't bring it home.
Newcastle disease, being a virus, is often spread in manure or people's clothes, mechanical movement on equipment, shoes, things of that nature.
Steps like washing hands, cleaning and disinfecting clothes and equipment before moving to or from a poultry area will help prevent spread of a virus. Healy says an additional biosecurity measure is isolating exhibition birds returning from shows for 30 days before placing them with the rest of the flock. And if a flock owner notices birds that are sick or have died in an unusual manner,
reach out and get professional help. That could be your local county or university extension, your local veterinarians, or state or federal have resources that can reach out and help you find the right people to do some diagnostic work on those birds.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Thanks, Rod. And a recent report from Rabobank shows dryness in the South is pointing towards tightening of beef supplies. The beef quarterly report shows beef cow slaughter numbers are up 10% through mid-April from a year ago, driven by ongoing dry pasture conditions and the likelihood of forced herd liquidation during the coming grazing season, as reported by meat industry publication Meeting Place. Beef production and consumption are both increasing, adding some building pressure on the world's major beef markets, along with the potential of a drought year here in the U.S. I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West. AgriView with Everett Greiner is next.
Well, I've just about made up my mind. If I want to live and be healthy, I'll have to live on cabbage and onions. I mean, any other food may cause cancer or heart disease. No, it's not really that bad, but it is bizarre. Look at beef. It has been condemned by more health groups for a longer time than any other food. And beef is still the most consumed meat in the world. It's still under attack. And remember when eggs were targeted? I almost gave up eggs for breakfast. Pork has had its detractors, too. So many other foods, I don't have time to list them all. Now, I read where an article about coffee. Coffee. Can you imagine? Coffee is the only breakfast beverage I ever heard of. Now, by some standards, coffee can cause, I don't even want to say it. So, if you want to stay healthy, cabbage and onions. And that's Ag Review for today. Everett Greiner, AgNet West.
This is Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. We'll be right back. Welcome back to AgNet West's Farm City Newsday. More agriculture news for you now.
All that effort that growers have put into dust control? Well, as it turns out, that dust is a good thing to some of the life forms in our world. Scientists have learned that dust is a vital source of nutrition for the trees at high elevations. The really high up trees, like those gnarly looking bristlecone pines way up in the Sierras and the Great Basin region. Research scientists from the Department of Geology and Geophysics at the University of Wyoming and from the Department of Earth and Environmental Sciences at the University of Michigan have been looking at nutrition sources for trees in mountain ecosystems. They found that dust-derived nutrients can be vital to those trees that live on or near bedrock at alpine levels where the erosion is a slow process. The trees gain more of their nutrition from the dust that blows in than from the minuscule amounts that are released by erosion of the bedrock. In the California Sierras, where the study was conducted, about half the dust could be traced by their isotopes to the western U.S. Obviously, farming in the Central Valley is a dusty business. However, this testing also showed that the California mountains got a lot of their dust from China. As it turns out, there are millions of tons of dust in the atmosphere moving around the globe pretty much the same way that moisture does. Just as rainstorms start in the Pacific and bring us rain and snow here in North America, dust from Asia and Africa gets picked up and blown all over the seas and deposited on the land. Have you ever been in a haboob? That's what some people call a dust storm. They're common on the world's deserts. They happen in the same way on the Sahara in the Middle East and Australia and the American Southwest. The dust cloud can be seen for miles away. It can be 50 miles wide, it's thousands of feet tall, and it can travel 50 or 100 or more miles. The lightest particles stay airborne for weeks or months, sometimes circling the globe, till they come to rest and are absorbed into the soil somewhere. Strange to think, but that tiny grain of sand you might have swept off your tractor seat, it might have started out in Africa or China. So, once again, we see that farming feeds the world. But also those mountain goats, marmots, chipmunks, and other critters up there, they're getting half their diet from Chinese food in a roundabout way. It truly is a small world. I'm Lynn Wilcox, and that's the Western View from AgNet West and Citrus Industry Magazine.
Making your own fertilizer out of household waste. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. Take a look around your kitchen, and chances are you already have the right ingredients to make your own natural liquid fertilizer for your garden. All that's needed is to get more in tune with your household waste, such as used coffee grounds or banana peels. Soak them in water for a couple of days and make an infused water to give to the plants. Wood ash from real firewood is especially good for tomato plants. Have a fish tank? The soiled water is a great source of nutrients for garden plants. Just be aware of any chemicals that have been added to the tank water. If it's been treated with non-organic stuff, it might be better not to use it on the garden. Freshly cut grass soaked in water or rainwater for a few days is also a great nitrogen and phosphorus-rich liquid fertilizer. Using a combination of these things can be great for your garden and also save you some money. Win-win. I'm Kathy Eisen for AgNet West.
Good day, everybody. Albert J. Hernandez, the Untamed Chef for AgNet West, and welcome to the California Kitchen, where you can learn how to cook in under 3 minutes or less from an award-winning chef. I'm your host with the most. Let's get started. So we're coming back from the Mushroom Mardi Gras last week. We had an absolute blast. Everybody had a lot of fun. And one of the recipes that I told everyone I would share was going to be the milk chocolate mushroom Rocky Road. Yes, I did just say that, milk chocolate mushroom Rocky Road. Here is that recipe that over 400 people really, really enjoyed. Let's get started. So the very first thing we're going to do is we're going to be doing a bain-marie method. Now, bain-marie is a nice way of saying in French, a double boiler method. Now, the way I did my double boiler method when I was on stage was I took a pot of water, and in the pot of water, I put a smaller pot with nothing in it at all. I turned the heat pretty much to a whisper of a flame so we could slowly and lowly melt our milk chocolate. Once I had our milk chocolate fully melted down, I turned the heat completely off, removed it away from the water, and then I added to this as well 1 tablespoon of vegetable oil, just so we could put the shine onto our chocolate. The next step was very simple. We took 1/4 pound of the chocolate, and we put it inside of the melted chocolate with the oil, so we could get a beautiful temper. Now remember this, when we're tempering this chocolate, I tempered to 172 degrees. And you have to be very, very careful whenever you're tempering down. And to help with the tempering as well, I added to this walnuts. Once I added in my walnuts and I felt the chocolate was starting to get a good, the texture was starting to really start to, not harden up, but it's starting to get firm. The next thing we're doing is adding in the mushrooms. Now, for anybody who typically loves Rocky Road, this is a more of an unorthodox way of making a Rocky Road. However, at the 39th annual Morgan Hill Mushroom Mardi Gras, all of my wonderful fans and viewers who came out to see what we were doing absolutely enjoyed this recipe. So like I said, keep it real simple, and all you have to do to finish this off is you put it in the refrigerator, preferably leave it in the refrigerator on a sheet of parchment paper. But if you don't have any parchment paper, at least make sure you have an oiled pan, and this is going to help a whole lot. And then I like to get a piece of parchment paper as well and put it over the top of the chocolate, so that way it doesn't take on any extra moisture, or if something falls, it's not going to mess up what we worked so hard to make. For this and many more of my recipes, go to my website at www.ajhtheuntamedchef.com. And as always, this is Albert J. Hernandez. You can call me the Untamed Chef for Agnet West.
This is Farm City Newsday by Agnet West. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Farm City Newsday by Agnet West. I'm Taylor Hillman. In today's specialty crop news brought to you by the Almond Board of California, you can find them online at almonds.com. Whole split is just around the corner for almond growers. The Almond Board of California's Bob Curtis has five things you need to be doing this time of year.
It's Bob Curtis, Director of Ag Affairs, Almond Board of California.
Bob, so whole split is fast approaching. The Almond Board has five steps for growers to remember as they go through this period. The first one's kind of a no-brainer, but the second one deals with navel orange worm, and that's important with the issues that we saw last year, right?
First of all, at whole split, there's a lot of things that growers and PCAs have to juggle to pull everything off correctly. One of them is obviously knowing when whole split is and detecting it correctly. Obviously, there are going to be some blanks that will split prior to the crop. That's a good heads up that whole split is on its way. And then, of course, the initiation of whole split will be in the upper outer regions of the tree canopies, particularly in the southwest. And you want to keep that in mind because the next critical thing to consider or manage at whole split is your whole split spray for navel orange worm. It's very important that this spray go on very early on at whole split. It's somewhere around 1% of whole split in the orchard. You don't want to just focus in on the trees on the edge, although those are also going to be a good indicator as to whole split to the majority of the orchard is on its way. Efficacy for whole split for navel orange worm, you want to key in on that 1%. Again, in the upper outer portions of the tree. Now, by and large, over the years, that 1% whole split coincides exactly with the flight of the navel orange worm. But just to be sure, and in case, you want to double check your egg traps. If you've got them in there right at the beginning of whole split, they're still effective. You can take a look at your pheromone traps that catch moths to see if you've got activity. And then, of course, the third thing you can do is actually take a look at the splitting crop and see if you can detect eggs. The important thing is that we, even though we key in on the stage of the crop, because that predominantly coincides exactly with the navel orange worm activity. But on the other hand, you want to make sure you've got activity before you just go ahead and pull the trigger at that 1% whole split. There's some very good materials out there that work for navel orange worm. Two of them that are real workhorses for us, and they have a very good fit in IPM programs, are Intrepid and AlphaCore. There in the past, pyrethroids have been used. Those are effective. However, there's some caveats to pyrethroid use. One of them is that pyrethroids are particularly tough on beneficial insects, and the other very important consideration is that we now have resistance of navel orange worm to the pyrethroids. So if you use them, you want to use them very judiciously, and actually maybe only once per season. Now that's the initiation of whole split, but if you've got sufficient pressure and activity, you might want to take a look at a spray 2 weeks after that initial spray. And this is, as we know, is a fairly common practice to have two sprays at whole split, one right at the nose, the front nose of whole split, and then one 2 weeks after.
And there is other pest management involved at this time too, right?
Another very important consideration, again, in terms of pest management is how you handle hull rot. And we know, and again, there's a lot going on at whole split that you've got to manage. We know based on prior research funded by the Almond Board that stressing the trees a little bit just during that front end of hull split is a very effective way of reducing the amount of hull rot in the orchard. And actually timing that and applying it just the right amount of stress is a little bit of a tricky business. In a perfect world, everybody would have a pressure chamber and you'd monitor that stress. Say, for instance, starting at hull split and going into maybe like 90% hull split, and you want to have a slight stress of minus 14 to 18 bars during that period of time. If you don't have a pressure chamber, another way to look at it is cutting back your customary irrigations by 50%. You don't want to reduce the frequency of your irrigations, but rather the amount that is applied. But the third aspect that's kind of tricky about imposing this period of stress is the type of soil you have. Obviously, with a very light soil, it doesn't take much to get your stress initiated, and heavier soils, and the growers will know this based on their own experience, you may have to cut your water or cut back on your water quite a bit ahead of your normal hull split period to reach that desired level of stress.
Now, this time of year, end of May, early June, nitrogen management now can actually help with hull rot.
Another aspect to managing hull rot at hull split is be mindful of your nitrogen program. The Almond Board and the University of California put out a very good nitrogen management plan. And the whole idea is that it's gauged to the crop potential and therefore how much nitrogen you should put on. And in that program, you don't want to exceed the amount of nitrogen within that budget. And for instance, the application that would go on typically in late spring, early summer, right at kernel fill is May to early June. So again, following the schedule and not over-fertilizing with nitrogen is very important to managing your and reducing the potential for hull rot.
One of the tips you guys have is dealing with aflatoxin. That's something new, so talk about that a little bit.
We now have a new tool in the almond industry. It's a biological control to reduce the amount of, ultimately the amount of aflatoxin that is produced coming from the orchard. The way this mechanism works, it's, well, first of all, the product is called AF36. It's Prevail. It's commercially available. And the way it works is that you actually seed a material into the orchards about 2 weeks prior to hull split. And these are wheat seeds that actually contain fungus. The fungus that creates aflatoxin, and it's an aspergillus fungus, there's different strains. There's the strains that cause the aflatoxin, and then there are also the strains that are called atoxigenic or do not create aflatoxin. The material that is seeded into the orchard contains the aspergillus that does not produce toxin, and the whole idea is that it will get a head start and displace the niches, if you will, of the toxin-forming aspergillus so that you really reduce the amount or the potential for aflatoxin generation within the orchard.
Now that leads us to harvest, Bob. And as we've talked before, a timely harvest is really important. That's the last point here, right?
You want to start your harvest at 95 to 100% hull split, for instance, of your nonpareils. And the goal should be to get those onto the ground as quickly as possible, particularly the earlier splitting varieties like nonpareil, because once those nuts are on the ground, the navel orangeworm that adults that are females that are left in the orchard will tend to lay their eggs on the pollinizer varieties rather than move down to the ground level and lay on navel orangeworm move down to the ground level and lay on the nonpareil crop. So those are all very important things to consider, very much in terms of a pest management approach at hull split.
This is Farm City Newsday by Agnet West. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Agnet West's Farm City Newsday. More agriculture news for you now.
The month of May is not even over yet.
But it is looking like we are going to experience our warmest U.S. May on record.
Agriculture Department meteorologist Brad Rippey, lots of temperature records shattered over the weekend. Des Moines, 96 degrees. Chicago, a near record, 97. And in the 90s, up into Wisconsin and Minnesota, the three previous record hot Mays, 1934, 1936, 2012, all drought years. But this May has been wet in most places.
But you do have to be concerned with the persistence and the expansive nature of this warmth in that it is increasing crop moisture requirements, and it also contributes to more evapotranspiration, so we lose more moisture from the soil. So as long as this unusual warmth continues, we will have to be concerned with getting rains, or things very quickly can dry out.
And Rippey says it looks like the warmth will continue perhaps through the first half of June. In Washington, Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Supporters of genetically enhanced food say perhaps its most significant benefit is hope, in the form of solutions for malnutrition and starvation in the developing world. Margaret Ziegler of the Global Harvest Initiative provides examples.
There are many companies looking at how to improve vitamin A content of crops, rice, sorghums, millets, etc. And it's possible to do it. It would bring great benefit actually to the poorest people who actually grow and consume those products.
Yet there are challenges introducing these products in several developing countries due to regulations and food safety concerns. Tom Slate of the U.S. Grains Council says continued education for both regulators and consumers is aiding GE food and crop entry in places like sub-Saharan Africa.
That sort of regulatory cooperation, if one country approves it, other countries say, okay, well, if you approve it, good enough for me. We're starting to see some progress there that's encouraging. I think what really sells first is safe and quality food.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Now recapping today's top story. The U.S. announced two dates this week when new tariffs will be imposed on trading nations. Mexico and Canada have remained exempt from new metal tariffs the U.S. has put into place. But that exclusion ends this Friday. NAFTA talks are ongoing and are centered around automotive issues, but several ag issues are still at stake, including the newly spurred issue of Canada keeping imported wine off of British Columbian shelves. The Wine Institute says Canada is a big market for U.S. wine. Any change that would create a more even playing field in that market would include a lot of opportunities.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit Agnet West online at agnetwest.com. You can follow Agnet West on Twitter and Facebook with @AgnetWest. Follow Brian German with @BrianAgnetWest, Danielle Leal with @DLealAgnetWest, and Taylor Hillman with @TheManOfTheHill. This has been Farm City Newsday by Agnet West.